So today we're doing more lecture than lab. We're not doing anything from the Bio-Rad book. The lab part is playing around with these microscopes, but before we get to that, I need to give you a little lecture on cells, because cells are the fundamental unit of life. Cells are the smallest thing that you can have that has all of those properties of life that we talked about in the first meeting. Reproduction and growth and development, all those things. That you have to have at least one cell to undergo all of that stuff. And also, a cell is what defines an organism, remember. You can't be an organism unless you have at least one cell, which is why viruses are not organisms. And you can argue whether or not they're alive. They are basically just molecules that are involved in life, but they're certainly not organisms. Well, this first slide shows you a logarithmic scale of sizes. So you have to be careful that you realize this is a logarithmic scale. And a logarithmic scale, it's not linear. A linear scale is like this meter stick. Doesn't matter which one of these tick marks you're talking about, they all represent the same distance. Right? But in a logarithmic scale, every major tick mark is 10 times bigger than the one below it. So if you go up 2 tick marks, it's 100 times bigger. 3 tick marks, 1,000 times bigger, and so on. Kind of like your plates were 10 times apart, an order of magnitude apart. And so this covers a very huge range of sizes, all the way from a tenth of a nanometer. And what is a nanometer? Yeah, a nanometer is 1/1,000,000th of this length, which is tiny. And this is a tenth of that. So 1/10,000,000,000th of a meter, which is the size of, we're getting in the range of the size of atoms, inconceivably tiny. And it goes all the way up to 10 meters, which is bigger than most organisms. There are some organisms, you know, trees that are bigger than 10 meters. But this includes almost all living things. And notice that we are near the top. We are ourselves much bigger than most organisms on Earth. The topic of this chapter, though, or this slideshow, is the cell. And cells come in a huge variety. But despite that huge variety, there isn't a huge range of sizes of cells. Cells, almost all cells of the world exist within these two yellow shaded regions here. And cells are small from our point of view. Notice that most cells are too small to be seen by the naked eye, which is why we use microscopes and why they're out today. But there are a couple major styles or kinds of microscopes, which are light microscopes and electron microscopes. They're fundamentally different because they work for different reasons. Light microscopes use humanly visible light that's passed through the specimen, the thing that you're trying to magnify, and then that light goes into your eyes. Right? In other words, you look into the microscope. Whereas electron microscopes use, instead of light, they use beams of electrons that bombard the specimen. And you don't look into them. There aren't optical lenses. Instead, the image is formed on some sort of screen, like a computer monitor. That's a difference in how they work, but there's also a big difference in their ability to resolve particles. Resolution is the ability to resolve two items. And what I mean by resolve them is to tell them apart. In other words, if you have two dots, which can represent anything, if there are in fact two dots, then they'll only look like two separate dots if you're able to resolve them. You put two dots on the wall pretty close to each other, and if you stand back far enough, you'll see that as one dot. In other words, your eyes fail to resolve the two. if they just look like a single dot. And so there is a limit to any kind of microscope to how to the resolving power. And but the greater the resolving power, the more detail you can see at that low level. And electron microscopy or electron microscopes have much higher resolution than light microscopes. But notice that the range over which light microscopes are useful includes the range that cells' sizes are at. Therefore, light microscopes are very good at looking at cells, and even though they don't magnify as much as electron microscopes, they have the advantage of being able to view living cells. Now, sometimes you kill the cells in order to see them with a light microscope, but it's possible to view living cells moving around and stuff under a light microscope. You can't do that with an electron microscope. Electron microscope will give you a hell of a lot more detail, but you have to kill the cells first. All right, so that's where we are here in this chapter, in this slideshow, at the level of the cell. Remember where the cell is in the overall hierarchy of biological organization. Remember, we want atoms, molecules, organelles, and then cells. And then cells make up tissues above that. All right, slide 2. This is a cell, obviously, but it is a cell that belongs to which of the two major groups of cells? What are the two major groups of cells? Yes, prokaryotic and eukaryotic. And which one is this? This is a prokaryotic cell, because it doesn't have a true nucleus, right? That's what defines a prokaryotic cell. Every cell, whether it's prokaryotic or eukaryotic, has a plasma membrane, though, or cell membrane, they mean the same thing, which is what really defines the cell. The reason a cell is a cell is because it is enclosed by a plasma membrane. So the plasma membrane really is the boundary between that cell and the rest of the universe. And all cells have that. But in a prokaryotic cell, that plasma membrane is the only membrane it has. Now, it doesn't have to be shaped like this. This happens to be a bacterium. What other kinds of organisms are prokaryotic besides bacteria? Do you remember the domains of life? Domains are the most broad, the most inclusive of the groups of animals when you groups of organisms when you classify them. Fungi is a smaller group. Fungi is a kingdom, and kingdoms are enclosed within domains. Included within domains. What did you say?
Archaea.
Yeah, archaea is a domain that consists entirely of prokaryotic cells. And bacteria is its own domain. So they're different from each other for other reasons, but they are similar in that they are prokaryotic. And then all of the eukaryotic cells of the world and organisms exist within eukarya. We're in the domain eukarya as animals. Okay, so since a prokaryotic cell has only one membrane, we've talked about this before, there's only one compartment. Right, everything within that plasma membrane is in the same compartment. And what do we collectively call all of that stuff? All the stuff inside a prokaryotic cell together is called what? The cytoplasm, exactly, which literally means cell stuff. All right, and we've also talked before about the fact that even prokaryotic cells need DNA. They need DNA for the same reason eukaryotic cells do, as codes for how to make their proteins. It's just that DNA is not housed within its own compartment because it's not enclosed by its own membrane. So the area that is part of the cytoplasm but that consists of prokaryotic DNA is called the nucleoid. Like a nucleus, but not a true nucleus because it doesn't have its own membrane. Although prokaryotic cells, remember, are defined by the fact that they don't have a true nucleus, it's also true that they don't have any other membrane-bounded organelles. Right? Not, it's not just that they don't have a nucleus. They don't have any membrane-bounded organelles. And what are membrane-bounded organelles? What does it mean to be membrane-bounded? Organelles that are enclosed by their own membranes. Yeah. So they only have one membrane. Therefore, the organelles that you find in prokaryotic cells are ones that do not have their own membranes. And these are ribosomes, which are these little brown dots here. Now, ribosomes occur in our cells as well, eukaryotic and prokaryotic cells. But the reason that they're able to occur in prokaryotic cells without violating that definition is because ribosomes are not membrane-bounded organelles. They're non-membrane-bounded organelles. All right? And what is the job of ribosomes? Have I mentioned this? Yes, these are the organelles at which proteins are assembled. So I've already told you that DNA stands as the code for how to build proteins. Well, the actual building process occurs at ribosomes. Okay? So the DNA is like the library, and the ribosomes like the workshop, if you're going to make these proteins. Now, this bacterium has a cell wall. Not all prokaryotic cells do, but many do. And cell walls are found external to the plasma membrane. It's like a tougher, much thicker outer covering. And this is why they're able to withstand certain things in the environment that cells that don't have a cell wall, like our own cells, would not be able to tolerate. Okay, now these flagella that are coming off the one end of this bacterium, you won't find that in all bacteria either, or all prokaryotic cells. But any cell, whether it's prokaryotic or eukaryotic, that has flagella, and the singular of that is just flagellum, U-M, those flagella are for locomotion, meaning for getting from point A to point B, moving the cell through the medium or the surroundings. All right, most of this slideshow is about eukaryotic cells, though. And so the rest of the slides will really apply to eukaryotic cells. Not necessarily eukaryotic cells only, but from now on we'll be talking mostly about eukaryotic cells. Thank you. Now, really, in a sense, what defines the cell is the plasma membrane, like I said. And a plasma membrane is a very special device. First of all, every cell that's ever existed for the billions of years over which life has evolved has had a plasma membrane. And therefore, there wouldn't be any life without plasma membranes. So you literally owe your life to the fact that membranes exist. And these membranes are a special collection of molecules that have some special properties that make them assemble the way they do. What you have here in this cartoon is a piece of a plasma membrane. The cell, we're very close up here. These are individual molecules, so the cell would be big, much bigger than the slide. We're just looking at a little slice of it. And you can see that as far as the structure of a plasma membrane is concerned, it's mostly made out of these gray and yellow two-tailed molecules. Notice there's many of these things. Each individual one, though, has a gray head and two yellowish tails on this slide. These molecules are called phospholipids, and it's impossible to overstate the importance of this, because without phospholipids, there would be no life. Now, as the name implies, phospholipids are lipids. That's the type of macromolecule they are. But what makes them so special is that phospholipids are examples of molecules that we say are amphipathic. Now, have you ever heard this word before, amphipathic? Yeah, let's. Amphibious is a good word to use, or amphibian. What is an amphibian? What kind of animal is an amphibian? Frog is an example, but what makes it an amphibian? Exactly. Amphibians are animals that live part of their life on land, part of their life in water. Amphi, the prefix, means dual or both. Bi, as in biology, means life. So amphibian means someone with a dual life, land and water. Well, amphipathic also has that same dual meaning. And pathic, as in pathos, means feeling. So really, in this sense, it means preference, dual preference. Amphipathic is a word that we describe certain chemicals with. Amphipathic chemicals are molecules that have one part of their self that is hydrophobic and another part that is hydrophilic. Another way of saying that is one part of the molecule is polar and the other part is nonpolar. Polar and nonpolar have to do with whether there are charges, electrical charges involved, because of the distribution of the electrons and the protons. Well, if something is polar, that means it has a partial charge. If something is nonpolar, it's neutral. An amphipathic molecule has one end of the molecule that is partially charged and the other end is neutral. Water itself, or water, which is an important part of life, water is a molecule that is polar. And polar molecules like to be around other polar molecules because of the interaction between the charges. Nonpolar molecules like to be around other nonpolar molecules, but polar and nonpolar molecules avoid each other. Okay? Well, an amphipathic molecule is part polar and part nonpolar. The word that we give to molecules that like to be around water is hydrophilic. That literally means water loving. So water itself is hydrophilic, but so are other polar molecules. On the other hand, nonpolar molecules are hydrophobic, which literally means water fearing. It means that they're nonpolar and therefore they don't like to be around water for chemical reasons. They don't like to be around not only water, just they don't like to be around any polar molecules. Okay, so if we look at one, if we just imagine one of these phospholipids, the head part, which is the gray part, is the polar part, and therefore it's the hydrophilic part. It doesn't mind being around water. The two tails are nonpolar and therefore hydrophobic. They don't like to be around water. So if you have a bunch of these phospholipids, all identical to each other, and you put them into water, and there's no life involved, we're just talking about molecules. You just put a bunch of these molecules into water, they will, on their own, assemble into this two-layered structure that we call a membrane. This is a lipid bilayer, a phospholipid bilayer. One membrane thickness is really two layers, so we call it a phospholipid bilayer. And the reason that these molecules will self-assemble into a lipid bilayer is because the hydrophobic tails are trying to avoid the water. So the tails come together with tails on the other layer, and that leaves the heads exposed to water on one side and these heads exposed to water as well. And when you complete that, it will make a bag, basically, which is the makings of a cell. This is how life evolved. Okay, this is how the first cells came into existence. So when you have a complete sphere of this stuff made, you now have separated two aqueous environments, two water-based compartments, the extracellular fluid and the intracellular fluid inside. But a complete plasma membrane is more than just phospholipids. Phospholipids are like the infrastructure of the plasma membrane, but you also have to have other things embedded in there for the cell to operate. So that's what these purple things are, and these are proteins of different kinds. Okay, the reason that a phospholipid bilayer is so important is because it defines the cell and also disallows passage of certain things through it. So if you can imagine that there is something that is hydrophobic that's out here in this extracellular fluid, in other words, a non-polar particle, it would have no problem going right through this membrane if it's small enough, because these tails that are in the thickness of the membrane, they are nonpolar as well. So it'll slip right through. But if you have an ion, for instance, which is a charged particle, even if it's small, an ion isn't going to pass through this, because an ion's charge makes it not want to be at all by these things that have no charge at all, these tails. So it not only separates two watery environments, it also allows only certain things to pass through it. Well, to live, a cell needs certain things that won't go right through the phospholipid bilayer to get through as well. And therefore, you have proteins in there that allow other things through under the right conditions. All right. Now, in slide 4, we're looking at something that illustrates the notion of surface area to volume ratio. And this is an important ratio because it constrains or limits the size of cells. Now, we're huge organisms by most standards, by the standards of most organisms. We started out tiny, though. We started out as a zygote, which is a single cell formed by the fusion of a sperm and an egg. Two cells fused into one cell. That's how each of us started. Now we're much bigger than that, trillions of times bigger, but not because we just had that one cell grow into a huge cell the size of us. Right? We grew by increasing the number of cells that we're made out of. Not all organisms do that. Some organisms stay as one cell, unicellular organisms. All bacteria, all archaea do that. Some eukaryotes do that even. But most eukaryotes are multicellular organisms. And therefore, they're able to be big. There's no such thing as a huge organism made up of one cell. And that's because the size of cells is limited. Cells can't get indefinitely big in all three dimensions. Now, it is possible to have... I'll talk about that in a minute. Let me explain why, though. This cube, labeled 1 here, that represents a cell. And 1 is its dimension on each side. It's a cube, so it's the same distance on all three dimensions, right? So it's 1 by 1 by 1 cube. It doesn't matter what you say the units are. Just 1 unit by 1 unit by 1 unit. Because we're going to use it for comparison. That's why it doesn't matter what the units are. If we want to measure the surface area of that cube, we notice that a cube has 6 identical faces, right? So you just compute the surface area of one face and then multiply by 6. What's the surface area of one face, though? Well, it's length times width, so it's 1 times 1, which is 1. Therefore, the surface area for the entire thing is 6 square units. That makes sense? If we want to compute the volume, though, that's length times width times height, which in this case is 1 times 1 times 1, or 1 cubic unit. And therefore, the surface area to volume ratio which means the volume divided by the area divided by the volume is 6 divided by 1, or 6. The surface area to volume ratio tells you how much surface there is for each volume you have. So there's 6 times as much surface as there is volume in this cell. It's a high surface area to volume ratio. Now, if this cell were to grow bigger, if we're to get 5 times bigger in all 3 dimensions, so get 5 times wider, 5 times longer, 5 times taller, then you'd have this big cube, right? Now we can compute area and volume for this. Well, one face is 5 times 5, 25 square units of area on each face, but there's 6 of them, so there's 150 square units of area. But the volume is now 5 times 5 times 5, which is 125. Now notice that area is still bigger than volume, but area grew from 6 to 150, which isn't as much as volume grew. Volume went from 1 to 125. Okay? So now the surface area to volume ratio is 150 divided by 125, which is just 1.2. Smaller than 6. In other words, when a cell grows in all 3 dimensions, its surface area to volume ratio goes down. And that's mathematically simply because area, which is x squared, goes up like this. Volume, which is x cubed, goes up much steeper. So the volume grows faster than the volume does. I mean, the volume grows faster than the area does as the cell grows. All right. The reason that's a big deal is because for a cell to live, it has to be continuously exchanging energy and materials with the environment. It needs to bring things in. It needs to get rid of things. Well, where do you bring things in and get rid of things if you're a cell? At the membrane, which is the boundary between the cell and the surroundings. So it's like a city, right? A city needs certain things to come in. Those things come in at the boundary of the city. Well, if you grow, that extra volume means you're going to need even more stuff, and you're going to have to get rid of even more stuff. If you grow too big, you won't have enough area to actually bring in enough stuff or get rid of enough stuff. In other words, if your surface area to volume ratio gets too low, you will no longer be able to live because you won't be able to exchange at fast enough rate. And therefore, cells don't get huge in all 3 dimensions. It is possible for cells to grow very long but still stay very narrow and very short. For instance, a nerve cell or neuron. There's a neuron that runs from the tip of my toe all the way to the base of my spinal cord. That's one cell, right? Almost a meter long. But the reason that it still has a high surface area to volume ratio is because it's very tiny on the other 2 dimensions. So it got long without getting a big volume, right? When you compute the volume, you have one big number and then you multiply it by 2 tiny numbers. The answer is still small. And it's similar to, you know, when you make hash browns, you have a potato that has a surface area to volume ratio, a pretty small surface area to volume ratio, because there's a lot of potato in there that's not going to be exposed to the oil, because only the surface gets exposed. But if you shred it first, every little piece has more surface area compared to its volume. And therefore, every little piece gets brown. And we prefer that. Most people do. All right, that's surface area to volume ratio. Let's go to... it's getting dead cells in here. Slide 5. Slide 5 is a catch-all cartoon showing an animal cell. And not all cells are animal cells, of course, but our own are, because we're animals. And what I mean by a catch-all is that this single picture tries to show just about all the possible organelles or little cell organs that an animal cell can have. It doesn't mean, though, that every animal cell has all of these. Let me quickly go through what these things do. The nucleus, which is the big purple thing, is an example of an organelle that is doubly membrane bounded. It has two membranes, an outer and an inner membrane. And the nucleus, which remember is found only in eukaryotic cells, the nucleus' main job is to house the DNA. Now the DNA is not the only thing that's in the nucleus. To keep the DNA from being just a tangled mess, because DNA molecules are very long, DNA is complexed with a bunch of proteins. And that mixture of DNA and proteins is called chromatin. So that's the stuff you find in a nucleus. Chromatin is the stuff that chromosomes are made out of. I'm sure you've heard of chromosomes. Chromatin makes up chromosomes. Don't worry about the nucleolus, but the nuclear envelope is just the name of those two membranes that surround the nucleus. Now this blue stuff that's surrounding the nucleus and is folded back and forth, that's all one organelle. In fact, all of this and all of this network stuff that is the same color of blue, that's all one organelle that is collectively called the endoplasmic reticulum. And the endoplasmic reticulum, even though it's all one organelle, can be broken down into the two parts that look different. The rough ER, which is all of this pancake stuff, and the smooth ER, which is the part that looks more like a net. Now, the reason that the rough endoplasmic reticulum is called that is because of all these brown dots that are on its surface. And what are those brown dots? Ribosomes. And we already said what ribosomes do. Ribosomes are for building proteins. Well, the rough endoplasmic reticulum has all of these ribosomes attached to its surface because the job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is to take brand new proteins that are being manufactured on these ribosomes and modify them a certain way, package them, and send them on their way. Right? The smooth endoplasmic reticulum, on the other hand, doesn't have these ribosomes associated with it, which is why it looks smooth, and it has a different function. It's not about modifying proteins. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum, or smooth ER, is primarily for lipid synthesis, building lipid molecules for various reasons that the cell needs. And it's also a place for cells to store certain things, like calcium ions, for instance. This is how your muscle cells work. They store calcium ions in the smooth ER until the muscle gets activated, and then it releases the calcium ion. That's part of the signaling that tells your muscles to contract. Okay, now, in teal, or greenish color here, you have something that looks very similar in shape to the ER. It's right next to it. But this is its own organelle. The greenish one is called either the Golgi apparatus or the Golgi complex, or some books just call it the Golgi. What it does is receive packages of proteins from the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Remember I said it passes them on to somewhere else. Well, that somewhere else is the Golgi. It receives these packages of modified proteins. The Golgi can modify them further, but whether or not it modifies them, the Golgi figures out where those proteins need to go to do their function, and therefore repackages them and ships them on their way to their final destination. That final destination can be somewhere else in the cell. It can be embedded in the membrane. Remember, the plasma membrane has proteins in it. Or some proteins are shipped all the way out of the cell and work in the extracellular matrix, as it's called. So the Golgi apparatus operates as a shipping and receiving, or a receiving and shipping center, in that order. These large bean-shaped organelles are called mitochondria. That's the plural. If we're talking about just one of them, it's a mitochondrion. And a mitochondrion is another example of a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. Notice this one's been cut away so you can see the interior of it. It has two membranes, one inside the other, just like the nucleus. The major function of the mitochondrion is a complex set of chemical reactions that collectively are called cellular respiration. And the reason that cells undergo cellular respiration is to maximize the amount of energy that they can extract from food and store as ATP. Store temporarily, because ATP, once it's created, it's going to be spent so that you can use that energy that was originally in the food to do some expensive process in the cell. That all occurs in the mitochondria. You also have, notice these little finger-like projections at one end. Not all cells have these, but this one has them at one end. These little finger-like projections are called microvilli, microvillus for short, just like cactus is the singular of cacti, not for short, for singular. Microvilli are a way to drastically increase the surface area without very much affecting the volume. Now, this whole cell has been cut away, right? So you can see that you can imagine this surface where my finger is going as a beach. You know, you have the ocean out here, outside the cell, and this is like a beach. Out here, right here where it's smooth, and you need to get from here to here, whatever distance that is, it would be a pretty much straight walk, right? You'd be taking a pretty direct way. But if you went that same distance over here, and you had to stay on the beach, you'd be making a much longer trip, right? Well, similarly, the cell has a lot more membrane here than it really needs to enclose that volume. Therefore, it has drastically increased its surface area. And why would a cell do that? Well, if it needs more surface area, which it typically does, if it has to have a bunch of exchange of materials through that membrane at that place. For instance, in the lining of your gut, whose job it is to absorb the food that you eat after it's been digested. The food molecules are way too big to go into cells, so your food is digested really outside of your body. Your digestive tract is not in your body. It's just a tube. It's a hollow tube like a pipe that your body is built around. Right? So everything from mouth to anus, that's really outside of your body. And the food gets digested outside of your body, but in the intestines. And then once the molecules are small enough, they will go through the plasma membrane of the cells lining your gut, and therefore they are now in your body. Well, to do that requires a bunch of transport proteins to transport those food molecules into the cell, and therefore you need a lot of membrane to house all those proteins. And that's a good example of where you'd find microvilli. The cytoskeleton here refers to a complex array of three major kinds of proteins that give structure to this cell. A cell is not just a bag of loose organelles floating around randomly. It's highly ordered because it has a very complex array of these three major kinds of proteins: microfilaments, intermediate filaments, microtubules. And you see those just as these lines here in this drawing. But not only do these things form a skeleton for the cell, which is what cytoskeleton literally means, but they also form little roadways along which things can be walked from place to place within the cell. And you see a flagellum on here as well. This is in an animal, which is a multicellular organism. You don't typically find flagella, because flagella are for cells that live on their own, right? For unicellular organisms. But we do have flagella on which kind of cells? No, I mean we as eukaryote, we as animals do. What kind of human cells have flagella?
White blood cells?
No.
Sperm.
But when you think about it, sperm are like their own little organism living a very short life on their own, right? Their life, they either die or they make it to an egg and fertilize it, but that's all they do. So they to get from, that's a pretty long journey through the vagina, up the fallopian tubes, to get to the egg in terms of body lengths for the sperm, because it's tiny. That's a long swim, so it needs the flagella. Okay. Lysosomes are little membrane-bounded organelles. They're like little sacks of membranes in which things can be digested safely away from the rest of the cell, because the things that digest proteins, for instance, lysosomes can break down proteins that need to be disassembled. Well, the things that break down those proteins are proteolytic enzymes. Proteolytic simply means splitting proteins. Proteolytic enzymes are dangerous things to have around because the cell itself is made up of a bunch of proteins, and you wouldn't want to start disassembling things you don't want to have disassembled. So that's done safely in a lysosome. All right, let's go on. I look at a plant cell in slide 6. Now, there's a lot of repetition here because plant cells have most of the things animal cells have as well, but they have some things that animal cells don't have. For instance, plant cells have a cell wall. Now, they have a plasma membrane like all cells do. That's this thin orange layer. But the much thicker brown layer that's outside of that is the cell wall. And this is why plants, just like I said earlier, bacteria are able to survive certain conditions that would kill animal cells. Plants also can survive those because they have these tough, thick outer cell walls. I'm not going to repeat the ones I've talked about in animal cells. Something that you find in plant cells that are not in animal cells, though, are central vacuoles. A central vacuole is a large membrane-bound organelle, so it's a big sack, basically. And it looks empty, which is why it's called a vacuole. It's vacuous or empty, but it really isn't empty, of course. The reason it looks empty is because mostly what's in there is water. Although the plant cell can also use it as a dumping ground. So it can put certain things it doesn't want in the cytoplasm into the central vacuole. But it's mostly water, and this is why plants can grow much faster than animals. Plants and animals are both multicellular organisms, so they both grow by adding additional cells, each of which have to be small. But a plant cell doesn't take as long to build if a lot of the volume is taken up by a central vacuole containing just water. And that's because water doesn't have to be built. It just comes from the environment. It gets absorbed through the roots. And this is why some cells, depending on the species, some plants literally overnight get noticeably bigger. Animal cells don't have this central vacuole. They're made of stuff that needs to be assembled by the cell, which takes a lot longer. The only other thing that I want to talk about in a plant cell that animal cells don't have are these big, conspicuous green organelles, which are called chloroplasts. And chloroplasts are the third example of an organelle with multiple membranes, as you can see here. So nucleus, mitochondrion, and chloroplast all have multiple membranes, not just one. And the job of the chloroplast is photosynthesis, which is what plants can do, not just plants, but plants are able to photosynthesize. Syn means together, and synthesis means bringing together multiple things to make it a bigger whole. Photosynthesis refers to the fact that light, photo means light, light energy is used to synthesize something, to make bigger things out of smaller things. That stuff that's made in photosynthesis is sugars. So photosynthesis allows a plant to make its own food. It produces sugars out of much simpler carbon dioxide and water molecules. The two things that you need to give a plant, carbon dioxide and water, and it will produce its own food. We can't do that, therefore we are not considered producers. Organisms that are able to make their own food, photosynthetic organisms included, are producers. All of the organisms that need to rely on some other organisms for their food are called consumers. We are consumers. Some consumers eat producers. Some consumers eat consumers that eat producers. Some consumers eat consumers that eat consumers that eat producers, and so on. That's the so-called food web. Okay, now we can more quickly go through the next few of these. Slide 7 just shows you a better view of the central vacuole by itself. Point here is that it does indeed take up a large volume, which is why a plant cell can get pretty big fairly quickly just by absorbing water. Slide 8 shows you a better view of the transfer of proteins from the rough endoplasmic reticulum to the Golgi complex. And remember I said that both of these organelles package these proteins. What I meant by that is they enclose these proteins in their own little pieces of membrane, their own little bags, which are called vesicles. This little circle right here with the three purple dots in it is a vesicle. Where does the membrane come to make up these vesicles? It comes from the organelle itself. Notice that right here you have a vesicle that's pinching off from the surface of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. So the wall of this vesicle used to be part of the membrane that makes up the Golgi complex. So membrane gets moved around within cells all the time. And now, since membrane is the same material, basically, in all organelles and the plasma membrane, this vesicle can fuse to the surface of the Golgi and spill its contents into the hollow interior of the Golgi. By the way, the general word meaning the hollow interior of a structure is lumen. So these proteins that were just modified, just built on these ribosomes and then modified by the rough endoplasmic reticulum, are now being spilled into the lumen of the Golgi, and the Golgi figures out what kinds of proteins they are and therefore where they need to go to function properly, and the Golgi will pinch off a bit of its own membrane to package them in a brand new vesicle, which will either spill them out of the cell or embed them into the membrane or move them to a lysosome, for instance, or something like that. I got to change these batteries. Battery. Might be it. All right, slide 9 shows you a mitochondrion just in closer detail. So this is where cellular respiration is occurring. You get a clear view of the fact that it has two membranes, an outer and an inner membrane. And therefore it actually has just the mitochondrion itself, which is much smaller than the cell. Just the mitochondrion has two chambers in itself. A chamber that's between the two membranes called the intermembrane space, and a chamber inside the inner membrane, which is called the mitochondrial matrix. And we're not going to go over cellular respiration, but that's where all these reactions occur that allow for the complete breakdown of fuel molecules in order to get as much energy as possible out of the stuff we eat and therefore make as much possible ATP, energy-carrying molecules of ATP, for the cell to use for whatever expensive purpose. Interestingly, the mitochondria have their own little pieces of DNA and their own ribosomes in them as well. And this is because mitochondria came to be early on when cells engulfed other cells, which would normally kill the cell that's engulfed. It would be used as food. But for whatever reason, some survived and started living within the cell, and those became mitochondria. You can see they're kind of like little bacteria themselves. Oh, yeah.
Damn it.
Oh, no. It worked that time. Slide 10 is a close-up of a chloroplast. You see multiple membranes. And the anatomy of a chloroplast is that the membrane that's making up all this green stuff, which is called the thylakoid membrane, that's all one membrane that has this elaborate shape. And it goes back and forth and makes these coin-looking structures that are called thylakoids that occur in little stacks. So several thylakoids make up one stack. One stack is called a granum. And a single chloroplast includes many grana, and therefore many more thylakoids. That's where photosynthesis occurs. And a typical plant cell will have about 50 of these chloroplasts in the cell. And therefore, they can collect a lot of sunlight. And this is what makes them green, by the way. Chlorophyll is a pigment that collects the sunlight, absorbs the sunlight, and allows it to use that energy. But that's what makes it look green to us. Slide 11, which I think is the last slide, just shows you flagella again, which I've already mentioned, but it also shows you cilia. Both flagella and cilia are cellular projections, things that project off the surface of the cell, and they are both motile, meaning involved in movement. They're motile structures. The big difference is the size. Flagella are much longer than cilia. And the location. For a cell that has flagella, those flagella are usually at just one end of the cell. Whereas if a cell is ciliated, cilium is the singular, by the way, and it means hair, because these things look like little hairs. If a cell has cilia, then it usually has cilia over much or all of its surface, not just at one end. But they both move back and forth. Both kinds move back and forth, or whip. Well, if you have a cell that has a flagellum, like these sperm, then, like I said, that's propels the cell from point A to point B through the medium. So flagella are about moving a cell through a medium. If you have a cell that is on its own, not attached, not part of a multicellular organism, just living on its own, then cilia can also propel it through the medium. On the other hand, you could have a cell that has cilia, but it's attached to a surface, either attached to some non-living surface, like a rock, or attached to other cells within a multicellular organism, like in us. For instance, the cells that line our trachea, or windpipe, produce mucus and they have cilia. They produce the mucus because it's sticky, and when we breathe in stuff that contains a bunch of particles of stuff you don't really want in your lungs, really all you want to get to your lungs is the oxygen, those particles of debris get stuck to the mucus. But the cilia are beating back and forth, and therefore the particles that stick get swept backwards away from the lung up to the throat where we swallow them, which is the perfect thing to do for debris, including things that might hurt you that are living, like bacteria. Perfect place to put those is into your stomach, because the stomach is the most inhospitable part on the body, because it has such low pH. It's so acidic that it will kill most things. So it's like a garbage disposal. So cilia can work for locomotion, getting propelling the cell through a medium, or cilia can move the medium across the surface of the cell. If the cell is stationary, it can move the medium in a current next to it. Let me make sure that's the last slide. I think it is. Yeah. Okay, so let's break for 5 minutes and then look through the microscope.